Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
On average, we spend nearly one third of our waking life alone. Whether we love it or try to avoid it, we can make better use of that time. The science of solitude shows that alone time can be a powerful space used to tap into countless benefits.
Out now from Cambridge University Press, Solitude translates key research findings into actionable advice. From relaxation and recharging to problem solving and emotional regulation, solitude can benefit personal growth, contentment, and our relationships. Use the discount code SOLITUDE20 to save 20% on the cost of your copy at cambridge.org/solitude.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark, and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm okay, Alex. How are you?
I'm fine, Lucy. I've been awfully busy. Do you know what? Last night, I was doing an online event for the Writers' Prize with seven writers.
Gosh.
I know. This podcast now looks thoroughly depleted to me.
Well, I'm terribly sorry.
I know. Could you try to throw your voice? I mean, it was a feat of traffic management, but it was just so wonderful to talk to Naomi Klein and Zadie Smith and Paul Murray and all
at the
sorts
same
of
time.
All at the same time.
Really? Wow. And was everybody sort of spaced out all over the world?
Well, Naomi Klein was in Canada and a couple of people in Ireland, including me. And I think the others were UK-based, but they could have been anywhere, as could our audience.
Well, that sounds completely thrilling. Gosh.
And then I spoke to the novelist Tommy Orange, whose second book, Wandering Stars, is about to come out. So I've had a busy old week, but I'm raring to go.
Good.
With this week's podcast, which I know we will be talking about, and we all work too much, won't we, a bit later on?
Yes, we will. Yeah. We're back on the ideas of the work ethic.
But what have you been up to?
Well, I haven't been up to very much, but I have seen some stuff that I would like to be up to.
Mm.
This is for our listeners who are both bookish and have a lot of spare money and are incredibly stylish. So probably all of you.
Oh, that's that Venn diagram.
It's all of us. Yes,
yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah,
because I've been reading about, there's a new exhibition at Bon Marché, which is one of the big shops in Paris. You know, the Grand Magasin, they're all very beautiful. Bon Marché is the one on the left bank, I think. It is. It always made me laugh at it being called Bon Marché, because that usually means something is a good deal or a bit of a bargain. It's certainly not cheap. Bon Marché. It's very, very chic. In fact, it's so chic, can I tell you, that I was in there once, not buying anything. I don't think I ever bought
looking.
Anything. Just looking, yeah. And next to me, browsing the rails, was the French film star and wondrous actress Fanny Ardant, looking just like exactly like she looks. Isn't that thrilling?
Oh.
So it's that kind of place.
Yes,
and they've
I
got
see.
An exhibition at the moment called Mise en Page, which is about... It's all about books. It's curated by the co-founder of Colette. Do you know Colette?
No, tell me more.
Very, very, again, very chic, very expensive store in Paris, which I don't even know how to describe it. It just sells lots of lovely things that you want and mostly can't afford. And this is curated by this lady who I think also runs a publishing house. And it's an exhibition. She's got the artist. He's called Jean Julien. And there's a huge, it's worth looking up because he's made these huge figures of people reading like bookworms. He fills the whole main room of the department store, he or she, is a reading figure, a kind of bookworm with a big book on their knee.
What, like a sculpture?
Sort of, but he seems to be sort of 2D, as though he's made of paper. Or she. I do keep saying he looks more like a he. It's worth having a look at. He's called Jean Julien. And the exhibition is called Mise en Page, if you want to go and have a look at it. And one of the lovely things about it is that there is, of course, a shop, if you can't get to the exhibition, with some amazing things in there. One of them that I looked at, there's a sort of perfume called Marque Page, which is like a bookmark. Can I read to you what it smells like?
Yes, please.
220 euros to you. So, okay. Yeah, you know.
It, big bottle, is it?
No, it's not very big. No, it's not very big at all. It's a very small bottle. It says it smells of leather and white flowers. Oh, it doesn't seem to be anything about books. It just smells of jasmine and orange flower. And it's supposed to remind you of a bookmark. There's another perfume.
I suppose
there.
The leather, I suppose.
Yes, I think it does. Mm. There's another perfume there. Oh, that's it, which I think we might have mentioned before, called Parfum Bibliothèque, which really is supposed to smell like a library. And this one says, the aroma of leather bindings mingles with the essence of the wood of the shelves. It sounds better in French.
Doesn't everything sound better in French? I mean, look, Lucy, leave the 220 quid out of it for a minute. I'm not totally sure I want to smell like bookshelves and leather.
Well, some people want to, because I seem to remember when this first one came out, which is called Bibliothèque. I think we mentioned it a couple of years ago because we were so taken by it. I think it's the same one. And it sold out almost immediately.
Ah, well, there we are.
So the bookmark one is new to me, but Bibliothèque, I think, has been around. That's 240 euros.
More expensive to smell like a bookmark.
Yeah, but it will immerse you. You'll have an olfactive immersion. I'm now doing literal translation. In the warm, rich atmosphere from a library from olden times. So musty.
Yes, well, okay. Might see if I can afford some postcards anywhere.
But definitely worth a look. Okay. And if you're feeling extra stylish, which I know you always are, Alex, I also learned that the designer Anna Sui, her most recent collection has been based on Miss Marple.
Oh, now that sounds more up my street,
I must say. So brilliant. And there's so part of the collection is people who don't look like the Miss Marple that we think of, dressed in kind of lovely Fair Isle and Argyle and tweeds. And the other inspiration from it is the first editions of Virginia Woolf book covers, which has got very particular blue and black and white. And I have to say, they're very, very nice clothes. I'm sure I can't even afford a sock. But it's worth a look, as I say, if you're feeling particularly bookish and stylish.
Oh, yes, I think I could
rich.
Be tempted to look at the Miss Marple clothes, if not actually part with my hard-earned in order to buy them. Could I look like Miss Marple anyway? Well, I'm sure there's an old tweed jacket or something and a little bucket hat knocking around somewhere. I might have a go. Should we get on?
Yes, I'm so sorry. I just was so taken by all of these things. I had to tell you all about them.
I love your tales of Parisian chicness, Lucy. You come in wafting an aura of, I don't know,
stale old books, musty old
books, and all that kind of thing. Only metaphorically, I mean. Anyway, without further ado, this week, novelist William Boyd joins us to talk about a pivotal moment in the Second World War, and Sarah Richmond on the perils of the work ethic. But first, novelist William Boyd is an accomplished maker of intricate stories in which different perspectives are layered to create an impressively detailed and often ambiguous whole. So who better to review an account of warfare that takes in numerous combatants and non-combatants in a range of situations and settings? The book in question is Peter Englund's November 1942, An Intimate History of the Turning Point of World War II. And we're delighted that William is here to tell us about it. William, welcome.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
It's wonderful to have you on the podcast and to be talking about this fascinating sounding book. It's that word intimate in the book's subtitle that is the key I take from your review. Is that right?
Yes, it's individual voices, 45 individual voices, covering this particular month in the middle of World War II. It's global. I mean, England cuts almost like a film between the different testimonies of these individuals, some of whom are famous, some of whom are just at the work face, some of whom are, you know, private soldiers or airmen. And with this kind of mosaic of voices, if that's not a mixed metaphor, there he constructs a portrait of this month, which he believes was the turning point in World War II. At the beginning of November 1942, it looked like the Axis powers would win. By the end of the month, 30 days later, it looked like the Allies were going to win. So that's his thesis, but he does it through the lenses of these 45 different people.
In terms of the shape of the war and the outcome of the war, do you agree with him? Is that month the pivotal month, the one to concentrate on, do you think?
Well, I think he makes a very convincing case that it is. There's another argument that it was December 1941 when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor that actually changed the course of World War II. But I think that England's thesis is that it was the first successes on the Eastern Front when the Russians began, particularly at Stalingrad, began to win against the German forces and drive them back, that made Germany's defeat inevitable. And I think that's, you know, that is a pretty commonplace thesis. And but he analyzes it, you know, on the ground, as I call it in my review, the worm's eye view.
Yes.
It's the individuals living through that particular month that somehow give credence to the huge global picture.
He kind of tells it from their point of view, doesn't he? So it's a mixture of presumably an enormous amount of research into their testimonies, but he is also voicing it, isn't he?
Yes, it's reported speech, as it were. I mean, there are quotes, of course, but I mean, he's obviously read everything that's to be read about these 45 individuals. And he, in a way, distills their testimony into these short, small nuggets of information as we cut from, you know, Japanese prisoner of war camp to a German U-boat to a young soldier on the Russian front. It's a very kind of wide conspectus, but it's his interpretation of what these people experience that is fundamentally the nature of the book.
I mean, it's almost the antithesis of the idea that history is written by the victors, isn't it? Because here you have it written, as it were, by everybody. And I wonder if you get that sense that the people whose speech he reports, whose testimonies he's bringing to us, are also aware that things are changing very rapidly. It's very hard to know with hindsight, isn't it, what people felt about the present that they were in and the future that was about to face them.
I don't think they did, in fact. I don't think in conflict, in a war, you know, the soldier on the ground really knows that what's going on, apart from the immediate danger or peril he is or she is in. I mean, he says here, this is his thesis in his introduction, he says, this form is experimental and arises from a sense that the complexity of events emerges most clearly at the level of the individual. And in a way, that's the revolutionary aspect of the book, that he's somehow taking the turning point of World War II, but making it a series of micro histories rather than a learned macro history. And I think that's what he pulls off so successfully, that when you finish the book and you've heard all these voices and you've lived through all these lives, and some of it's very harrowing and very shocking, you do have a sense how, as he says, the level of events, complexity of events are at the individual level. And I think that's what's, in a way, I mean, it's not, he's not the first to have done it, as I make clear in my review, but he does it exceptionally well in this case.
I mean, you say exactly that the great events of history used to be conveyed to us somewhat differently through battlefield events and the sort of macro history, as you say, and that the change came in the 1970s in book form with writers like Martin Middlebrook and John Keegan. And I wonder, is that because of the Second World War? Is it because there was so much testimony available, because there was newsreel, because there was footage of all kinds. Was that what made the change, do you think?
Well, I think it's also in the Second World War, most of the soldiers were literate, you know, not necessarily true of World War One. The common private soldier could read and write. And so there's a huge, if you like, literary tradition of testimony of World War II in a way that there isn't in World War One. The World War One was written, if you like, by the educated officer class. But in World War II, anybody who could write could make a statement. And I think that's a huge difference. There's a series of novels that the Imperial War Museum are publishing at the moment, which are all written by participants, but they chose to write novels about the war. And the testimony is absolutely compelling and fascinating. That wasn't true of World War One. There were a few officer poets, Soon and Owen, Graves and so on. But in World War II, I think it was a more democratic voice that was speaking. And I think that's exactly what England has exploited, because these testimonies, he didn't go and interview them. They're all written down, and he's just extrapolated their testimonials and presented them to us in this vast mosaic, as I say.
I wonder, do you think it's also that there was an appetite to hear the stories? I mean, I'm thinking of things like massive documentary series, The World at War. We seem to want so much to understand what had happened, in a way that maybe there was more of a culture of silence after the First World War.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, my grandfather and my great uncle both survived World War One and never spoke about it. Their sons were in World War Two and did speak about it. I think there was a shift in the demographic, if you like. There was a shift in the educational levels of the people fighting that made World War Two far better documented than World War One. And when you look at World War One, you look for the individual voices. There are really not that many books that tell you the story in the way that World War Two is covered. So it's a very interesting shift in culture and shift in social advantage, in a way. And that's why World War Two has got this amazing documentary presence in our life.
I wonder if it's also, I mean, you will know this much, much better than me, like a shift in history and the way that historians approached it, in that it wasn't anymore just, you know, great events and great men directing things. It was much more about the people who were experiencing it, or actually at the forefront of what was happening. We talked about the French Revolution a few months ago and how there's now micro histories of that, you know, and it wasn't just great events at the price of bread. It was all sorts of things. It was pamphlets and balloon crazes, and, you know, the real lives of the people who were going through it became, as you say, available, but also much more interesting, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, war and warfare, none of us have experienced it. And there is an intense curiosity, even a kind of, you know, almost slightly perverse curiosity to know what it was like. I mean, I've written in my novels about World War One and World War Two, and that's why I've done all this research and read these books in an attempt to try to get the essence of the experience of the individual participating in these appalling, stressed moments. And so you look for those testimonials, those memoirs, and those accounts that somehow make it real. And I think the grand historical view, where armies move and armies mass on frontiers and battalions clash, in a way sort of makes it a bit anodyne and academic. And what we want as readers or curious individuals is to know what it was actually like. And I think that's what has been the sea change in military history in the last 50 years, and as I claim, initiated by Martin Middlebrook and his amazing book, First Day on the Somme. And it's been hugely influential. And now I think all military histories, which are, you know, widely read and hugely popular, copy this procedure that let's take it down to one individual's experience and ignore the kind of grand plans that are being organized in the rear by generals and politicians. It's much more interesting the nitty-gritty than the overview.
You make the point that novelists have been doing this for a long time. You know, you mentioned Stendhal and Tolstoy, for example, and you've done it yourself, as you say, and I'm thinking of Restless, for example, and in other novels too. I remember that there's a line in Pat Barker's novel of the Second World War when she says, as you stand through, you know, watching the Second World War soldiers come back from war, it could be any, they could be Roman soldiers, because as far as the army is concerned, as far as soldiers are concerned, one cock up is just like the other. And there is a sort of truth in the way that even irreverently, novelists can get to the heart of that sort of emotional truth, can't they? And something that actually goes beyond a single conflict.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's that imaginary engagement with, I was involved in peripheries of a civil war in Nigeria as a teenager, and it completely changed my thinking about military conflict. But I, you know, I'm a total coward and have never had any kind of further experience. But it made me try to, as a novelist, try to recreate the absolute veracity of what goes on. And today, you just look at every soldier in Ukraine seems to have a body camera. And so now you can see conflict, which is almost like World War One, in fact, men invading trenches and shooting at each other from the point of view of the individual soldier. It's quite extraordinary to see how different it is from the movies, as it were. And I think that it's the same with the written word. And that's what Englund's book shows you, that the written testimonials, the witness that these people bear to the various experiences they have, whether they're a young woman in Paris in the French Resistance or a tail gunner in a Lancaster bomber, it comes through as something absolutely convincing and authentic. And we can vicariously begin to understand a bit of what it must have been like.
It appears to me as well that I mean, we're talking about, you know, doing it as a novelist. That's what you do. Peter Englund is a historian. So it's a different set of skills, isn't it? For him to be able to write that well from the point of view of all of these people. I mean, not every historian can do that, can they?
No, exactly. And I think that's a key point, because you don't want to make it sensationalized or in a way too novel-like. It has to still, if you're a serious historian presenting a serious historical thesis, you still have to have it grounded in all that scholarship. And I think that he achieves that balance perfectly well, as do, I think, all the popular military historians, Anthony Beaver, James Holland, Middlebrook. They get that balance right. It's scrupulous, but it's vivid. And I think that's the sea change, as I present it in my review, a kind of new form of historiography that somehow, you know, great events are now being presented in a slightly different way because of this concentration on the individual experience.
You also mentioned, of course, that there are, this worm's eye view extends to all sorts of people, but also some really well-known figures. So Camus is in there, Vera Brittain, Vasily Grossman.
There are lots of, you know, well-known people. I mean, Vasily Grossman was with the Russian army in Stalingrad and wrote about it, you know, at great length in his sort of historical novels. Camus was part of the Parisian resistance as well. So, I mean, Englund has taken unknown voices and he's taken very well-known voices and woven them together to form this, you know, this great tapestry of this particular month.
Mm. We should say as well that it's not written in English, is it? It's translated.
No, it's very well translated. Yeah. I'm just trying to remember. We must always mention the name
Peter
of the translator.
Graves,
Peter,
yes.
Peter Graves, yes, exactly.
I mean, that seems an incredible feat in itself when you're talking about such raw and immediate writing.
The good translators do an absolutely brilliant job, you know, and they render it into an English, which is a fantastically rich language, you know, perhaps the richest language that exists, but it reads seamlessly well, I must say. And he's done a fantastic job in turning the Swedish into a very, very readable, you know, limpid English.
William, thank you so much for talking to us about this book. Now, this is an invidious thing to ask a writer, I know, but may we ask you about your own work briefly and what you're working on at the minute or have been interested in recently?
Well, believe it or not, I just handed in my new novel yesterday. So,
what, in the wonderful first day of your holiday, you've come to talk to us?
On your day off.
My day off. I thought I must do the TLS podcast. That novel will be published in September this year. It's a Cold War, sort of multi-layered Cold War spy thriller set in the very early 1960s. So I've been steeped in that world for the last, for many months. But I finally kicked it out of the house and it has to go and earn its living. I'm actually now going to go and write screenplays. I have two very big projects, which are poised and ready. So I'll have my day off and I'll be back to work on my movie life.
Now, look, we really don't need to tell you this. I think you should take the rest of the week.
Right. Thanks very much.
Go and have a nice lunch somewhere, walk through the park, see a film.
Yes,
really?
Exactly. No,
maybe not a film. Maybe that's Coles to Newcastle.
That's right. Yes.
Oh, yes.
I will indulge myself. Don't worry.
But it sounds as though you are very much recommending this book. It may have to join the very large library of war-related books in my own house. I think the TLS is absolutely injurious to my book budget.
Yes, it is a triumph of a book, I think. And I mean, he wrote another book about the First World War, which is equally good, but with fewer voices. But this one is global in its ambition, and he really pulls it off. So it's fascinating, harrowing, but very compelling.
And just a final question to you before we release you to your well-earned title. I mean, you have written nonfiction. You write, as you say, screenplays. You've done all sorts of things, but you are primarily a novelist. Do you think you were always going to be? I mean, would you ever have been tempted in the direction of historian? Because all of your novels, in one way or another, are steeped in history.
Well, I don't think so. I think I am, first and foremost, a novelist, and fiction, in a way, for me, is the best way of explaining this curious adventure that we're all on. I mean, I have written a lot of nonfiction. I've been asked to write biographies, and I've always said no, because I think that it's just something to do with your temperament, in a way, that somehow, for me, the best way of coming to some kind of understanding about the life we all lead and the kind of people we are, it's paradoxically better achieved when you make it up. And so I'm not drawn to write nonfiction or at any great length, I must say. So no, for me, the novel, in a way, is the best way of explaining ourselves to each other.
Well, you are rather pushing at an open door on this
podcast. Yes,
I must say. William, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Not at all. Not at all. I'm very happy to do it. Thanks so much.
To come on the show, Sarah Richmond assesses why we all work so much and how to stop.
And to read all the pieces we talk about and much more, remember to subscribe to the TLS. Just head on over to our website at the-tls.co.uk.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare.
PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about Thoreau and his ideas, particularly his ideas about work. For instance, his suggestion that everybody work for money for around 6 weeks a year and devote the rest of the time to living consciously and meaningfully. Well, this week, we're looking at the other side of the coin, in a way, the work ethic. Sarah Richmond taught philosophy at UCL and has reviewed two books for us about ideas around the work ethic and how we might, just possibly, try and get ourselves some free time. Sarah, many thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So can you tell us about the first book, Hijacked, that you've reviewed? Can you tell us a bit about the author? You tell us about her in your piece and why you think this subject is such a fitting one for her.
Yes. Well, Elizabeth Anderson is an extremely well-known political philosopher, at least in the English-speaking world. She's writing now. She's been publishing very prolifically for the last 10, 20, 30 even years. But in the last 10 years or so, she's had a few very interesting books appear. So she's a very big name, as I say, in the English-speaking world. And she has carved out a bit of a niche for herself, especially more recently, by focusing on work in particular, and what fair conditions of work might look like. And so this book on the work ethic is one of the last in a succession of things that she's published that are loosely connected with the theme of work. Mm-hmm. Now, she made her name, I should say, in the 1990s. She published an extremely influential paper which every political philosopher in the English-speaking world will know, called What's the Point of Equality? And you might think that there's a lot of difference between talking about equality and talking about work, but she actually brings the two topics closely together, because in her view, the point of equality is that we should enjoy equal relations with each other. And what's wrong with many working relations is the huge inequality that they involve. Mm-hmm. So these two topics are also closely related.
Right. You also make the point when you're talking about her that, as you say, she's published an awful lot and written an awful lot. She seems to hold three professorships at the same time in the same place. Is that right?
Yes.
She knows about the work ethic.
Yes, she certainly does. I mean, she's had so many rewards, honours, invitations to lecture. You can find any number of YouTubes from all the international talks she's given. Yeah, she works very hard.
She works hard, yeah. So she knows about it from that
point. I suppose what that tells you, though, I mean, just the way that you describe her work, is that she is very absorbed in, connected to, and fulfilled by her work, and that she receives recognition for it. And I suppose one of the things she explores is the idea that actually that's not equal. People just don't.
Yes, she definitely does enjoy her work. She says in the introduction or in the preface to this book that she's actually not very good at leisure. She finds herself twitchy and wanting to get back to her desk.
Okay. She hasn't quite got Thoreau's 6 weeks of work down, has she? As you say, she begins by exploring the origins of the Protestant work ethic, right back to Luther, where that comes from. But this idea of ceaseless toil, which has often been or I suppose has recently been allied with capitalism, or as being an agent of capitalism. She says that's not necessarily the case, doesn't she?
Yes. I mean, it's not that she's an advocate of ceaseless toil. She makes a very important distinction between two types of the work ethic, which she thinks of as the conservative strand, if you like, and the progressive strand. The conservative strand would be the one that we might associate with the idea of ceaseless toil. The idea is that people need to work, however poor you are. It doesn't matter if you have to work hard, you may have to work even harder. Whereas the progressive branch, which is, of course, the branch to which she's sympathetic, is much more concerned with fair conditions of work. And that won't involve ceaseless toil, but it may involve a reasonable amount of work, which she would perhaps see as making a valuable social contribution in many cases, at least.
Mm. And is that also the idea of the Protestant work ethic? It's not work for work's sake. It's work in order to make a contribution. That's the idea, isn't it? It's work as virtue, actually, or as proof of virtue.
Yeah, well, there are a number of different sort of ideas, even within the conservative work ethic. So the phrase, I think I'm right in saying, was actually coined by the sociologist Max Weber. So that was a lot later, way after the first Protestant work ethic was formulated. Mm. And in his view, the Protestant work ethic involved accumulation. And so he did associate it with the spirit of capitalism. But as Anderson argues, it was originally a theological conception and it predated capitalism by a very long period.
Mm, mm. And so if we move to this progressive conception of the work ethic, you make the point that if you kind of go down that path, and this happened a lot in the mid-20th century, that kind of leads to social democracy, which in turn gives access to all sorts of rights that maybe weren't there before, to health and to education. And it's sort of like a, I mean, if you were charting the graph, it kind of went up, didn't it, in the mid-20th century after the Second World War, but has decreased in the past few decades. That's what she says.
Yes, that's exactly her view. She thinks that the inspiration for social democracy was a theorist that many people today haven't heard of. He was Edward Bernstein, a German political activist who began as a Marxist and then moved over to a more reformist conception of politics. But because of his Marxist leftist orientation, he was very big on protection for workers, workers' rights, you know, the legitimacy of unionism and those kinds of things. So, yes, what you say is absolutely correct. She thinks after the Second World War in particular, social democracy gained a foothold, at least in many European countries and perhaps in some others. And then in the 21st century, many of these progressive achievements have been undone.
Mm. If I understand right what you're saying, she wants to talk about work and to think about how it happens for us now to help with the challenges that we have today, doesn't she? And in particular with regard to the climate crisis.
Yes. I mean, she doesn't say a great deal about the climate crisis. I feel, you know, she probably thought it was imperative to mention it.
Mm.
And it is. And it is definitely a challenge facing us, but on a planetary level rather than a national level. And her point about the climate crisis is simply she thinks the existence and the seriousness of the climate crisis means that any idea that we're about to enter a sort of leisure society where we don't need to do much is for the birds. She thinks we've got a huge amount of work confronting us just
to deal with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Doesn't it also mean that the entire way that things are produced will need to change? The idea that you have a sort of untrammeled growth and therefore you need the labour to support that, is that whole framework is going to change too, will have to change.
Yes, yes, I think she would be sympathetic to that consequence as well, yeah.
So it will be sort of different kinds of work, and maybe we'll need to sort of concentrate our energies in an entirely different direction than simply just producing more and more stuff and consuming more and more stuff.
Absolutely, yes. And of course, what's interesting is that there was an anti-consumerist thread, although it probably wouldn't have been correct to describe it like that, right at the beginning when the work ethic was coined by the Protestants. So many of the Puritans and the Calvinists and people like that who believed in the work ethic thought that one dimension of the work ethic was frugality. So it really wasn't concerned at the outset with the idea of endless accumulation.
Again, I think where Thoreau would chime in, I mean, oddly, when we were talking about Thoreau, there was that odd thing where he says, oh, only work 6 weeks of the year. But in fact, he was incredibly hardworking and prolific and was constantly doing things. But it depends to what end, I suppose. When you say that she says, you know, this idea that we'll all have lots of leisure time is for the birds, that I feel like that leads on to the other book you review, which is called After Work, which seems to be about work that is not always recognised as work, i.e. domestic work, work in the home. And the promise has always been, or has it's felt like it's always been, that technology will save us from having to do much work, but that is not and has never been the case.
Yes. I mean, obviously you need to be a little bit nuanced with the picture. There are some technological inventions that have made a massive difference. I don't think anyone would say that it was less work to light a coal fire every day than to switch on the central heating.
No, that's true. But you have to work to pay for the electricity, to pay for the, I mean, I suppose you have to get the coal anyway. Sorry, go on. No, I'm just trying to unravel that.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, what you're taking us into is a very interesting theme of this second book, which is about the way in which when people talk about saving labour, you need to think about whose labour is being saved by the technology. And they've got so many excellent examples, many of which so many of us will be familiar with. So, for example, just think of those self-service machines in supermarkets, which most people hate using.
Yes, yeah.
And they're not necessarily making the customer's life any easier at all. They're simply a means of having less staff for the supermarkets.
Sarah, I've quite literally never used one without somebody having to come over to help me. I mean, literally, it's never happened.
Yeah.
So it hasn't even solved the problem of somebody in the supermarket's labour. But I was fascinated by that idea of the home as now this sort of locus of lots of kind of outsourced things that we might think, we might traditionally think of being done somewhere else, like medicine, for example, that kind of care, so that you would have equipment at home for caring for people with various range of illnesses and conditions that we would have formerly thought would be done in a medical setting, but that are now done at home, which, of course, you might think immediately, you'd think, well, that's a boon because somebody who needs treatment doesn't need to leave their home. But it's an absolutely double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah, it's another example of displacement, because what happens is that the relatives end up doing a huge amount of the caring, almost always unpaid, although there might be a small amount of state aid in some cases. So yeah, it's displacement of work from professionals to relatives.
And again, work that isn't recognised and that then becomes absorbed into the system so that it's expected and defunding occurs elsewhere and you end up with the situation that so many people find themselves in now.
Yeah, absolutely. And they mention, interestingly, that there's a sort of business model which encourages this, which is that, I mean, I don't know the fine detail of it, but within the medical system, money isn't allocated according to how long somebody stays in hospital. It's allocated on other bases, like a condition that's been diagnosed or maybe a consultant episode. And so, you know, there's a financial incentive as well to have the relatives cared for at home as much as possible.
It's very interesting, that idea, because you, if you just think about it on the face of it, you think, when if you're talking about, you mentioned, you know, everyone having a washing machine in the home, and then you would think, well, of course, it's great to have a washing machine in the home, because now you don't have to go out to the laundrette, and it saves lots of time. And again, that question, who does it save the time for? So it means we all do our washing ourselves. And actually having a collectively run laundrette, as long as it was properly run and the people there were properly paid and treated, is no bad thing, actually, because that provides employment for the people who work there, and then it's not all done in their home. Are they arguing for more sort of collectivization of that kind of thing?
Definitely. I mean, I think what they'd like to see are laundrettes where you could bring your washing, leave it, maybe it would all be piled together with other people's washing, which is something many of us might initially not be comfortable with. But the idea is that's genuinely labour saving.
Yeah. And that actually the people working in the laundrette, that's their job. They do the laundry the same way that, you know, if you had to make coal fires, the coal man would deliver the coal. But it's very counterintuitive, because now I'm sure if you said to most people, why don't you give up your washing machine and go down to the laundrette? Everybody would be horrified, wouldn't they?
Yes. Although, again, why not have someone who collects and returns the laundry? Oh,
no, that's a good idea.
Now that does sound good. But also, you know, it all depends on your perspective, doesn't it? Because if you're a person living, as many people in urban settings do, particularly in a very limited space, so there you are, you have your washing and then you've got a tiny flat full of wet washing, which is actually, you know, not great for your environment and the damp levels of your house and et cetera, et cetera. And you have no space. And, you know, it all depends where you're coming from, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. I just anecdotally, you know, I've talked to a few people about some of these ideas. And the thing about the laundrettes, especially if you're talking to a woman, people always, you know, really catch on to that idea and have a lot to say about it.
Yes, it's a really interesting point. When I was a student, we didn't have a washing machine, so I used to go to the laundrette, and I quite liked it. Because also, if you sit and look at your, I mean, I had a lot of time on my hands because I was a student, but it was quite, that's what I mean. If it's a nice environment where you could sit and read or have a think, or, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does definitely take longer. When the authors provide these kind of answers, are they convincing? Do they make a good case for them?
Yes. I mean, I think they make an excellent case when they're showing about the way in which labour so often gets displaced rather than saved. And so often, you know, it might change from being a market transaction to being a non-market transaction, or the other way round. So one of the things they mention of that kind of switch is things like Uber Eats and Deliveroo and so on, where a fair bit of cooking has now been, in a sense, outsourced and also become part of the market. So all of that, I think, is hugely interesting, really well documented. The thing I have a question about is what economic model they have in mind that would have to come about to support the kind of collectivization they're talking about. I mean, by definition, an individual can't do that on her own. So how's it going to come about? And that's the part of the story I think we need to hear a little bit more about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and how would we make sure then that, for example, delivery drivers and deliverers are in fact going to be paid fairly, because we kind of know across the board that they're not at the minute.
Mm.
So it would require a wholesale change, wouldn't it? Gosh, it would. I mean, I'm very taken by that. You're quite right, taken by this laundry idea, but I'm not sure I could part with my woolens.
Oh, I would. If somebody else would wash them,
you?
I would chuck them out the door. Yeah, I'd be very happy for someone else to do it. Perhaps you've got really nice woolens, Alex, and mine are substandard.
Well, I just worry about them coming back all teeny tiny.
Well,
which actually, to be fair, that happens in my house.
And do they think, Sarah, just before we really just basically talk about laundry for an hour and a half, you're right, it is weirdly fascinating.
Could easily do that.
Yeah. Do they think that there is any possibility that any of this will work and that we will have more free time or not really?
Well, I think, I don't want to put words into their mouth. The feeling I get from reading the book is that, along with a great many other people, they do think automation of all kinds of tasks is proceeding rapidly. So there may well be less work that needs to be done by human beings. But what they're concerned about, and I think this is really valuable, is this area of work that isn't mostly, or a lot of it isn't paid anyway. And so, okay, some people may have more time, their jobs may no longer exist. And what they want is a sort of across the board reflection about, okay, let's suppose, as it were, everyone in the country can benefit from this more free time. How are we going to make it work for all the unpaid professions or occupations as well? How are we going to make it work for, you know, people at home, people with small children, people caring for aged relatives at home, for all of those? Will those people get free time? And how are we going to make that happen?
Yeah, so it's an incredibly complex set of questions, isn't it? The more you look into it. But thank you so much for guiding us through it, Sarah, and thank you for talking to us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to William Boyd and Sarah Richmond.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.